Thanks for inviting me into your home, long haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Hour one. On this cold winter night, I find myself remembering my days as a paperboy delivering the Brantford Expositor. I remember delivering bad news on the doorstep in December of 1980, when John Lennon was murdered. Don McLean was a 13-year-old paperboy in New Rochelle, New York, on February 3, 1959. Hence the immortal lyrics, "But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver." Bad news on the doorstep. Here in the Eastern Time Zone, it is now Sunday, Feb 4th, but time zones to the west, it remains Feb 3rd, and it was 59 years ago, on a February 3rd, that Don McLean immortalized in the words, "The Day the Music Died," in his 1972 smash hit American Pie. The winter dance tour of the American Midwest, in the dead of winter on a broken down bus with no heat, seemed like a bad idea to begin with, and it would not end well. Just before 1 a.m., a chartered Beechcraft Bonanza aircraft lifted off near Clear Lake, Iowa, carrying three rock luminaries: Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and Giles Perry Richardson, a.k.a. the Big Bopper. The three were flying ahead of their bandmates to the next gig in Moorhead, Minnesota. Within minutes, the plane began a death spiral, crashed into a farmer's field. All three musicians were killed instantly and thrown from the plane. The body of pilot Roger Peterson remained inside. In hour one, we'll explore the final days of the doomed winter dance tour, culminating with the tragic plane crash. Why were those three gentlemen on the plane, and who got left on the bus? Is there any truth to the rumors that the plane was tampered with, or that there was some kind of foul play aboard the plane? And whatever happened to the wreckage of that doomed four-seater? My late friend and radio partner, our Gary Patterson, tried for years to pry some information from the plane's owner, Jerry Dwyer. Could that wreckage yield some clues as to what happened in the final moments before the crash? My guest in hour one would be the first to admit that he missed out on the entire Buddy Holly craze. It wasn't until much later in life that he accidentally got drawn into the music and the mystery. Gary W. Moore is the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. It's quite a remarkable journey, and Gary will share some incredible stories of Buddy and Richie and the Big Bopper's final days. And Gary may just have finally solved the mystery as to what actually became of that plane. In the last 3 hours of the program, Charlie Robinson is the author of The Octopus of Global Control, a work of nonfiction detailing how those in positions of power are able to manipulate society for their benefit, why they believe they're entitled to impose their warped worldview of reality on mankind, and how we can break free from their grip. The eight tentacles of control that are wrapped around humanity are the military, governmental, covert, physical, financial, media, spiritual, and scientific. And the book tackles topics such as uncovering the deep state, false flag terror events, the media's role in manufacturing wars, the 9/11 deception, the fraud of central banking, our broken education system. The Octopus of Global Control footnotes these important events by featuring quotes and firsthand observations from over 500 witnesses and participants that were involved in the most important events in our history. Their words add context and help to paint the picture of these historic events by explaining why these people were what they said, why it matters, and what actually happened. The book's exhaustive list of quotable quotes includes startling admissions from powerful political leaders who seem to be acknowledging the existence of a shadow government or deep state cabal. Take the 26th President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, whom Robinson quotes in the book. "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between the corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmen of the day." Again, that was Theodore Roosevelt, 26th President of the United States. Even late comic George Carlin gets in on the act. And Bill Hicks, who talks most notably about the murder of the 35th president. And no, I don't believe Alex Jones is Bill Hicks, so save your quarter. There are loads, again, of quotes from Carlin. Most are laced with profanity, but Carlin is pretty much sounding off on the cabal that he believed pretty much runs everything. The octopus of global control in the last 3 hours. The day the music died is next. It's a perfect winter's night to discuss such things. Here's one from George Carlin that's not in the book. There are nights when the wolves are silent and only the moon howls. This might be one of those nights. Gary W. Moore on the day the music died. Next. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Gary W. Moore is the author of the critically acclaimed book Playing with the Enemy, winner of the 2006 Military Writers Society of America Book of the Year. Playing with the Enemy is currently being made into a major motion picture by Academy Award-winning producer Gerald Molan. Gary is also a contributing author for Chicken Soup for the Father and Son Soul. With a degree in music education from Vandercook, Gary has performed professional music of all genres and taught students of all age groups. And he'll often mix his percussive performance skills into the subject matter at hand. He is, as I mentioned, also the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. Gary W. Moore, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Richard, it's such a pleasure to be with you tonight. Thank you. You're doing fantastic.
Likewise. Thank you. Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, the Big Bopper, in 1959, you couldn't get much bigger than that in terms of rock and roll stars. How did they find themselves in a broken-down bus with no heat touring the Midwest in the dead of winter? Not a great gig.
Well, rock and roll in 1959 isn't how we imagine rock and roll today. You know, the luxury buses, the jets, so on and so forth, it was really in its infancy. The money wasn't quite there, I guess is the best way to put it. Buddy found himself in 1959. He'd gotten married. He was having a dispute with his record label over royalties, and he needed the money. So they decided to go on this tour, and it was planned out of New York by people who had never been to the Midwest during the winter. They were zigzagging all across the country. They had doing this very cheaply and ended up in a bus that the heat just didn't work. And it ended up being, you know, a disaster that, you know, we're still talking about tonight.
And so the bus is carrying some of the side performers, because we should point out Buddy Holly and the Crickets were no more. The Crickets, they had parted company. Jerry Allison and Joe B. Malden they went their separate ways. So Buddy was starting anew, and he had some new sidemen, Waylon Jennings on bass and Tommy Elsup on guitar and Carl Bunch on drums. So how was it decided who would be on the plane and who would remain on the bus?
You know, how people got on that plane has been such a matter of incredible dispute through the years. Buddy had rented or chartered the plane, and he had chartered the plane because they had been unable to do laundry. And it was incredibly cold in Clear Lake when they arrived that day. The laundromat was closed. The pipes were frozen. So he chartered the flight in order to get to Moorhead, Minnesota in time the next day to be able to do his laundry. And he had chartered the flight for Waylon Jennings and Tommy Alpha. But Waylon just absolutely refused to get on the plane. He said he was afraid of flying. He was petrified, and he was going to take his chances on the cold bus. There was, you know, Ritchie Valens desperately wanted to fly. He had never flown in a small plane. And so there ended up being a coin flip between Tommy Alsup and Ritchie. And Ritchie won the coin flip and ended up on the plane. So it ended up being the Big Bopper, ended up being Ritchie, and of course, Buddy. One of the things that's often overlooked is in a small charter plane like this, and I used to own a charter service, you need to calculate your weight and balance very, very clearly. And they had calculated estimated weights based on Waylon Jennings, who was very skinny, Tommy Alsop, who wasn't a big guy, and Buddy, who was a very skinny guy. They weren't planning on the big bopper. And you may think, well, okay, an extra 80 pounds, is it going to make a difference? It does make a difference in a small flight like that. So those are the people who ended up on the flight. Those were not the people who were planned on the flight. And it ended up really being quite by chance and a matter of a coin flip.
I think, mentioned to me that earlier that Tommy Alsop ended up opening a bar or a restaurant in back in Texas, and he called it the Coin Toss Cafe.
Exactly. Tommy recently passed away just a few years ago. And it's interesting about this coin flip. For 50 years, everybody knew that Tommy flipped the coin, and that's just the way it was. In the last few years, Dion, who was on the tour, ended up claiming he flipped the coin. Bob Hale, who was the Masters of Ceremony that night, in the last years, he started claiming he flipped the coin, which was a source that really was hurtful to Tommy in his later years. Tommy called me one night very, very upset over the fact that these people were claiming it. And, why people would do that, I don't know. But I think that it's very, very clear. The history shows it was Tommy Alsop that flipped the coin.
And, of course, Waylon Jennings had said something to Buddy as he got back on that bus that he would regret for the rest of his life.
Yeah, Waylon and Buddy became very fast friends. And, in fact, Waylon, in his career, ended up singing two songs that were about Buddy. And he was on towards the end of his life, he was on a late night interview on WGN Radio in Chicago. And the subject turned to Buddy. And Waylon became teary-eyed. He said, I have regretted every day of my life, my last words to my friend. He said, Buddy, when he found out that I was refusing to go on the plane, he looked at me and said, well, I hope you freeze your butt off on that bus. And he said, I looked at Buddy and said, I hope your damn plane crashes.
Imagine having to live with that.
Yeah.
And he did till his dying day. The drummer for this newly formed band, Carl Bunch, he ended up staying on he was on the bus, and then he ended up getting frostbite. I mean, that saved his life ultimately, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. The people who were on that bus, most of them later said they were envious of the fact that the Buddy was, on that plane. They would have loved to have been on the plane with him. In fact, it was reported the next morning that Tommy Alsop was one of the people who had died in the plane, because he had given Buddy his wallet. And there's been a lot of different reasons why people have said he gave him his wallet. One of the reasons was he asked Buddy to check into the hotel for him for some reason, and he needed ID. And so it was first reported. In fact, his mother heard on the radio that Tommy Alsop was killed in a crash with Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes right down to it, as you've pointed out in your book, that Buddy Holly basically died, well, and Ritchie and the Big Bopper, because they wanted clean laundry.
Yeah. It's really an amazing thing when you think about Buddy Holly, who is arguably one of the inventors of this new musical genre, rock and roll. And we think of, the rock stars and the life that they live and so on and so forth. Buddy, he didn't die of a drug overdose. He didn't kill himself in behind the wheel of an Italian sports car. He didn't drink himself to death. He died because he just wanted to get ahead of everybody and get some clean socks and underwear.
You and I both know Peggy Sue Guerin, who's just fabulous, the Buddy's muse in many ways, the inspiration for two songs, Peggy Sue and Peggy Sue Got Married. Obviously, she's very close to this. She genuinely believes that there was some tampering going on with that airplane, that Beechcraft Bonanza. What is that possible, do you think?
I guess anything's possible. It's highly improbable. Peggy has the view that the mob had somehow tampered with the plane or put an explosive device at one point, she said, on the plane. she thought that Buddy had been being harassed by mob figures who wanted somehow to make a deal to tap into his royalties, and he was refusing. The mob was involved in the record business at the time. And that's just a matter of provable fact.
And Buddy did carry a gun, Gary. He carried a gun.
Well, and that shouldn't surprise anybody. Buddy was from Texas. And so, you know, yes, Buddy did carry a gun. He carried a gun because, you know, back then they didn't use credit cards. They didn't, I mean, he was in charge of the tour, and so he carried the receipts and the cash from every night. And so it wasn't unusual for him to have $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 on him. And so, yeah, he did carry a gun. But in order for the mob to be able to tamper with that plane, they would have to have been following him to Clear Lake, Iowa. They would have had to have been on site. And they would have had to known in advance Buddy was going to charter a plane. And the decision to charter that plane came late morning or early afternoon on February 2nd. So there was no evidence in the crash site of an explosion. In fact, there was absolutely none. And there's no evidence of tampering. And so, you know, I love Peggy Sue. She's, you know, but like a lot of people, like a lot of us, when people we love die, when people we respect die, it's coded somewhere in our DNA that we can't accept that they've died for sometimes the simplest reasons. And we look for it to be more. And I think that Peggy Sue, you know, does the same thing.
Roger Peterson, he gets overlooked often. He was the pilot. Mm-hmm. We talk about the three rock stars, but we forget about this other young man, Roger Peterson.
Yes.
What kind of training did he have? Was it pilot error then? Was it his fault?
Well, yes, it was absolutely pilot error. The NTSB at the time, the CAB, Civil Air Aeronautics Board, when they talk about pilot error, they're placing it strictly 100% on the pilot. Roger was a 21-year-old pilot. He had VFR training, which means visual flight rules. So he was qualified and licensed to be able to fly a plane when you can look out the window and see where you're going. He had taken his exam for IFR, which is instrument flight rules, and he had failed it. And so he was not qualified or licensed to be able to fly on instruments without visibility. And, you know, he found himself very, very quickly in a situation where he couldn't see a horizon. There was no visible reference point for him. And he flew that plane, you know, unfortunately, right into the ground. You ask, is it Roger's fault? And Roger Peterson was a 21-year-old guy who was flying his idols. You know, for Roger to say, I'm not going to go, isn't something that he was probably capable of saying. But Jerry Dwyer, Jerry owned the flight service, Jerry owned the airplane. Jerry was with Roger all day. He was Roger's employer. Jerry owned the airplane. He owned the charter service. By all accounts, people will tell you that Jerry Dwyer was a wonderful man and a pillar of his community, and I absolutely believe that. But good men make mistakes. And Jerry let that flight leave, roll down that runway, knowing that this kid wasn't qualified, understanding that the weather was something this kid shouldn't be able to handle, and he let him do it anyway. And here's the interesting thing, Richard. It was record cold in Mason City, Iowa, where they took off from the airport. Terrible weather. And Jerry helped load the plane. Plane started taxiing off down the taxiway, headed to the runway, and he went up to an outside observation point, and he watched the plane take off and kept watching until he saw the plane sink into the horizon. You know, I owned a charter service. At no point in my charter career did I ever watch a plane take off and stand there till it was out of sight. You know, I had confidence in my pilots. I had confidence in their qualifications. For some reason, Jerry stayed there and he watched that plane go. And you just don't do that outside when wind chill is below zero, unless you're worried. Jerry made a tragic decision to let that plane go. I'm a columnist also, and my column this week is, you know, the day the music should have lived, and it is kind of discussing that very point. That and again, Jerry Dwyer, I'm sure he's a wonderful man. I'm sure if he had the chance, and of course he recently passed away, if he had the chance to do it over, I'm sure he wouldn't let that plane take off.
All right, we'll take a quick time out. And when we come back, we'll talk about what may have happened to that wreckage, whether it may have yielded some clues as to what happened in the final moments of that chartered Beechcraft Bonanza aircraft. We're talking about The Day the Music Died with Gary Moore, author of Hey Buddy.
We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin. Three young singers who soared to the heights of show business on the current rock and roll craze were killed today in the crash of a light plane in an Iowa snow flurry. The singers were identified as Richie Valens, 17, Buddy Holly, 22, and J.P. Richardson, known professionally as the Big Bopper. The aircraft chartered from the Dwyer Flying Service crashed near Mason City, ironically the setting for the prominent musical The Music Man. The pilot, Roger Peterson of Clear Lake, Iowa, was also killed. The three singers had appeared at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa last night and were on their way to Fargo, North Dakota. Their small chartered plane crashed in a lonely farmyard about 15 miles northwest of Mason City. Cause of the crash was due to inclement weather conditions. Details upcoming from Action Central News.
Welcome back. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. Gary W. Moore is with us. We're talking about The Day the Music Died. On this date, 59 years ago, a plane crash took the lives of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and who you just heard coming back from the break. That's his hit, Come On, Let's Go, and of course, the Big Bopper. Think about this, that without Buddy Holly and the Crickets, there would be no Beatles. John, Paul, George, and at the time their bass players, Stu Sutcliffe, during their Hamburg days, were all huge Buddy Holly fans. And so when they were trying to come up with a name, a new name for their band, the Quarrymen, their original name after the school they went to was kind of growing long in the tooth, they thought about the Crickets, then Insects, then Beatles. Then eventually, after several variations, as a pun, Beatles, with an A, as in beat. Back with my conversation with Gary Moore, as we talk The Day the Music Died, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Gary Moore stays with us, the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. And we'll get into how you sort of, how Buddy Holly really found you, rather than the other way around. But I want to ask you about the final moments of the crash. As a pilot, what do you think happened, Gary?
Well, you know, for years it had been kind of stated that these guys didn't know they were going to crash. That the pilot thought he was climbing; he was actually descending and flew right into the ground. So there was no panic, there was no fear. That absolutely is not true. The crash debris, the way that it shows, the way that the plane struck, this plane was in a death spiral that the pilot could not recover from. It was his lack of experience and lack of instrument build. The last minute and a half, 2 minutes had to be absolute sheer terror on that airplane, unfortunately. And it's a terrible thing to think about, especially for the loved ones. But everybody in that plane knew that they were out of control.
And what's always been curious to me, my understanding was that the Big Bopper was in the back of the plane, and yet his body was found way out in front of the others, which has led to some to speculate, and it's rather gruesome, but the idea that he may have somehow survived the crash and crawled to the front. How else to explain how he got there?
Well, in my book, Hey Buddy, we talk about the details of the crash and what exactly happens. And we worked with a retired NTSB investigator, Dick Rodriguez, on this. And Dick says that, you know, it is not an unusual thing that as that plane hit with the wing, the back end of the plane was thrown over the top and people were catapulted out. Big Bopper was actually found 40 feet away in front of the wreckage. And so, you know, the estimate was he had to be catapulted 60 feet into the air. And His son, Jay, actually had the body exhumed in 2007 because he had just heard so much about these conspiracy theories, and he had actually started believing that Buddy had survived and his father had survived. His father was crawling for help, and Buddy shot him, which, you know, is documented verifiably not true. But he had the body exhumed, and there were two things that were found. First of all, there was no bullet hole. The second thing was found is the man who performed the autopsy said that he had trouble finding a single bone in his body that was not broken. So, you know, he was killed on impact, and he wasn't crawling anywhere.
Yeah, that is horrible to think about. I mean, there would be some comfort, I guess, in knowing that he died immediately and didn't suffer. I have to ask you about the wreckage of the plane.
Yes.
And what happened to it? And I mentioned my late friend and radio partner, R. Gary Patterson. He tried. He talked to the Dwyers, Jerry Dwyer, on a number of occasions. He talked to his wife, trying to find out where is the wreckage? What happened to the plane? And to no avail. What happened to it?
Well, I can tell you what happened to it. I found out quite by accident. When my book, Hey Buddy, came out, I was on book tour, and I was in Waterloo, Iowa. And there was a man sitting in the front row as I was giving my book talk, and he had his arms crossed, and he looked very, very grouchy. And I thought, well, he's upset by something that I've said in the book. So we get all done, and I asked if there was any questions. He immediately raised his hand, and he was quite obscene. I won't do it on the radio. But he basically said that if Jerry Dwyer says that he has that plane, he's a liar. And the whole crowd just stopped and looked at him. And he said, when I was 17 years old, my father owned a dump truck that he used part-time for hire. And he said, in July of 1959, Jerry asked my father to come with the dump truck after dark to a hangar. And he said he had some garbage that he wanted him to haul. And he said, he came to a hangar. There was the remnants of an airplane. And he said he paid my dad cash and said, take this someplace where it'll never be found. And Jerry doesn't know where the wreckage is, or didn't know where the wreckage is. But this guy gave me the location and exactly where the wreckage is and kind of how to find it. And so I'm kind of working with my publisher and a few other people. We may actually go try to recover that wreckage.
Do you think it could yield any clues as to what happened and sort of lay all the rumors to rest?
I don't think so. The wreckage was examined very closely by the CAB. There was no fire. Interesting thing about this crash is usually in a high-velocity crash like this, the needles will be broken off in the cockpit. But the needles were frozen, and so we know exactly how fast the plane was going at what angle it hit. It was pilot error, really pure and simple. A terribly inexperienced, unqualified young man at the helm of a high-performance airplane that was fully loaded to weight capacity in bad weather. People say, you know, they were surprised that they crashed. It would have been a surprise if they had arrived at their destination. That's the only surprise it would have been. This was a disaster that was really kind of programmed into happening.
Why did Jerry get rid of the wreckage that way?
Through the years, Jerry has and his family have said different things. One of the things that was said was he was receiving death threats. People were so upset over the fact they were blaming him for the crash, and he just wanted to dispose of it. During a crash like this, the insurance company pays the claim, then owns the airplane. And oftentimes what they will do is they'll offer it back to the original owner. They can buy it back and use it for parts. And, you know, Jerry, people have said that Jerry bought the plane back, sold off some of the instruments, the parts that were still in working condition, which wasn't very much. And then Jerry for years has said that he has the plane and he's writing a book. And he is the one who has perpetuated these conspiracy theories by saying the truth has never been told. The truth, you know, I have the truth. The truth is in the airplane. I don't believe he had the airplane. And there is no truth other than, you know, what we have in our book, Hey Buddy.
The name of your book, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, my new buddy John and my lost decade of music. Now, you're of an age where you could have appreciated the music of Buddy Holly while he was still alive. I mean, you would have been very, very young, but you sort of missed out on all of that. Your musical tastes lay elsewhere. So
yeah,
how
I was
then?
5 years
how, yeah, go
sorry,
ahead.
Go ahead. I was 5 years old when Buddy died. I don't remember him. I don't remember the crash. I know nothing about it. I was introduced to the music of Buddy Holly by my 75-year-old mother-in-law, Norma Wygant Jackson, who was a big, big Buddy Holly fan. And I was introduced to the music through a Buddy Holly stylist, impersonator, however you want to call him, named John Mueller, who is just does an amazing job. In fact, Maria Elena Holly, Buddy's former wife, says that John is the closest living thing to Buddy Holly that there is. And John wrote a song called Hey Buddy about Buddy Holly, and that's really what kind of captured my imagination and kind of sent me on this journey. The book Hey Buddy is not a biography of Buddy Holly. It's about my journey to learn more about Buddy. I had no plans whatsoever of dealing with the crash in my book. I write positive, uplifting, encouraging things. I didn't want to talk about a crash. But I got a call. I was trying to get a hold of Jerry and Barb Dwyer. They wouldn't return my calls, but Barb called me one day. And she basically, in almost a taunting way, she said, the truth about the crash has never been told. We're writing a book. We're going to tell the truth. The world will be stunned. And we have the airplane. The truth is in the airplane. And so it kind of sent me into this spin, so to speak, to really discover what truth they're talking about. And I think that we have the truth in the book.
I want to talk to you about some of the interesting paranormal aspects surrounding this story.
Yeah.
And Peggy has talked to me about her an incredible series of dreams she had about a plane going up and going down. And she warned her husband, who was the drummer in the Crickets at the time, Jerry Allison, you know, don't charter a plane. This was obviously months and months and months before the Crickets hadn't even broken up yet. She warned her good friend Buddy Holly, don't get on a chartered plane. She had that dream 3-4 times.
Yeah.
And then finally, of course, it came true. And then there's the story of Carl Bunch, who was the drummer who was saved by frostbite because he ended up in the hospital. And
right.
The night he tells he would. He passed away as well, but he told the story to our Gary Patterson about being visited by Buddy, the Big Bopper, and Richie. He saw them at his bedside
mm-hmm.
that night. He had no idea at that point that the plane had crashed. So what do you make of all of that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what I make of it. I there is enough reports of people. In fact, I've experienced a few. Who have these dreams, who have these that make me believe that there's something at work here. I can't explain it. Before my book came out, there had been some news reports about the book, some excerpts had been released, but it wasn't out yet. I got two very fascinating phone calls. The first one was I got a phone call from a woman who explained that she was a psychic or a medium, and she lived in a very bright lady, lived in Pittsburgh. And she said to me, she said, Buddy Holly's trying to talk to you and he's upset that you won't listen to him. And I just kind of laughed because that isn't the kind of thing that I had normally believed in. And she said, he's trying to talk to you. Well, a few days before she called, my wife woke me up in the middle of the night and she said, turn off the TV. And I looked up and I said, the TV's off. She said, well, there's a blue light behind the TV. Turn it off. So I looked up and it was like a blue circle behind the TV. A few days later, I was traveling for business and I was in a hotel and lo and behold, same thing. There was this blue light that was behind the TV and kind of moved out from the TV. And I thought I was imagining things, but back then there were tube televisions and they gave out light. And this woman said, I said, well, how would I know he's trying to contact me? And she said, well, generally when spirits, my experience is they travel in the form of a light energy. And she said, quite often it's a blue orb.
Wow.
And that, that just made my heart stop and I never saw it again. And she'd talked to me a few times afterwards and she said, Buddy's upset that you aren't listening to him. And I tried. I don't know. But I also got a phone call a few days before, you know, it was right around the same time. Got a phone call from Milan, Italy. And it was a man, and he's speaking broken English and broken Italian, and he started crying, and I couldn't understand what he's saying. Well, a few minutes later, he handed the phone to somebody who spoke better English, and he said that my friend was born on February 3rd, 1959, and he has had these night terrors all of his life of being in a very tight space, and he's spinning and he's getting dizzy and people are screaming and he's sick. And he says, all of a sudden it stops and he wakes up. And he said that, you know, a few years ago he had, you know, this guy wasn't a Buddy Holly fan, but he heard about the crash, started putting it all together. And, you know, he absolutely believed that for some reason, somehow he was experiencing the thoughts of or reliving being in that cockpit as that plane crashed. And as he explained it to me, what he was experiencing, and he couldn't have read this in my book, and my book is the only thing written at this point that really detailed what happened in that cockpit and in the experience.
Yes.
And he, as if he was reading it out of my book, he explained to me what he was experiencing. And so, you know, I have no explanation for those things. It's bizarre.
Well, there's a lot that's bizarre surrounding February 3rd, 1959. You've heard of the Buddy Holly curse, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. You have such a long line of people that were associated with the Winter Dance tour with Buddy. You had Ronnie Smith, who would go on to become the lead singer. No, he replaced Buddy on the Winter Dance tour, and then he died tragically. David Box took over as lead singer of the Crickets. He died in a plane crash almost at the same age as Buddy Holly. On and on. Yes. It goes. Eddie Cochran. Even Keith Moon of The Who, who the night before he died went out to see the Buddy Holly story in London's West End. What do you make of that, the Buddy Holly curse?
You know, I don't know what to make of it. So many people that you've had on this show, and I'm a fan of Coast to Coast, so I've listened for years, would probably be better explaining the you know, this type of activity than I can. I don't know. It's bizarre. It's almost unbelievable, but it's also undeniable when you look at almost anybody who touched Buddy in some way around the time of that crash. So many of these people ended up in tragic deaths. The odds of it being coincidental, you know, are millions to one. And so I don't have an explanation for it, but it's certainly something when you look at, you say, wow, this is hard to believe, but it's also undeniable.
Hey, Buddy, in pursuit of Buddy Holly, my new buddy John, and my lost decade of music. How do folks get a hold of this fine book, Gary?
Well, you know, they can get it almost anywhere fine books are sold. You can buy it on Amazon. You can go to my website. My website is GaryWMoore.com, and make sure you put in the W, or it takes you to the website of a dead rock star. GaryWMoore.com,
right.
and I can send an autographed copy. I would encourage anybody who's interested to take a look at this. You know, for several reasons. You know, first of all, it really has a different take and look at the music of that generation. But anyone who wants to know exactly what happened to that plane in detail, this is the only place you're going to find it.
Gary, a real pleasure. Thanks for hanging out with me for the last hour.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, when we come back, the octopus of global control. And we'll continue with a few Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens tunes as the night proceeds. Here's the Rolling Stones version of a Buddy Holly hit, Not Fade Away. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.